Hitler's War by David Irving. This chapter is called Silence of the Tomb. Werewolf in winter was a bleak and dreary sight. Battle-scarred aircraft stood around the local airfield. Impoverished Ukrainian peasants with starving horses trudged the fields collecting wood to warm their wretched hovels. The thaw was turning field and road alike into the now familiar muddy swamps. Guderian, who had not seen Hitler since December 1941, had found a changed man at Vinnytsia on February 21st, 1943. Quote, "His left hand trembled, his back was bent, his gaze was fixed, his eyes protruded but lacked their former luster, his cheeks were flecked with red. He easily lost his temper and was prone to angry outbursts and ill-considered decisions in consequence." End quote. Hitler had contracted a brain inflammation. Normally, several weeks of rest would have been imperative. He could not afford the time. Soon he was experiencing splitting headaches on one side, and one arm developed a tremor to which he drew Morell's attention. The doctor suspected that it was of hysterical origin, and he noticed Hitler was dragging one leg slightly, too. Hitler sat in his badly ventilated quarters, brooding and worrying. His staff expressed concern about his lack of exercise. He was seized by moods of black depression, which Morell tried to combat with injections of prostacrinum hormones, an extract of young bull's seminal vesicles and prostate, every other day. As the daily appointment book maintained by his SS orderlies establishes, from now on, Morell was nearly always the first visitor to Hitler after his private staff had awakened him each morning. Stalingrad had left deep scars within him. Outwardly, he was callous, ordering a new Sixth Army created forthwith and obliterating all trace of the old. A momentary problem was raised by the letters the survivors were now writing from Soviet captivity. Hitler ordered them destroyed. Why rouse false hopes among their families? Even deeper were the scars that Stalingrad had left within the Axis itself, symbolized at their ugliest by the hand grenade tossed at a German panzer general as he drove past a surly column of Italian troops marching back from the southern sector of the Eastern Front. Hitler learned to stifle his anger at these fitful friends. Quote, "I never want to see another soldier of our allies on the Eastern Front," he growled in private to Goebbels. "We can only finish off the Bolsheviks with our own soldiers, and particularly the SS," end quote. When Mussolini offered another 700,000 men, Hitler disdainfully commented to his staff that there was no point in equipping them with scarce German arms, which they would surrender at the first opportunity. Quote, "They can't even be assigned defensive combat duties," end quote. Yet when he learned on February that the bedraggled remnants of the Hungarian, Romanian, and Italian armies were being reviled, and that the Italian ambassador had complained that German units had refused any succor to the unarmed, dispirited, and hungry retreating troops, Hitler piously reminded his generals of the need for common decency and camaraderie. In an internal policy conference with Keitel and court historian Scherf on May 31st, he ruled against any overall communique on the Stalingrad operation, explaining that it could not be depicted without passing judgment on their allies. Hitler's respect for the Romanian contingent was less affected by their defeat, but on January 22nd, Germany had invited both Hungary and Italy to withdraw their armies from the Eastern Front. Hungary had, it must be said, suffered the bloodiest casualties, for her army was less than 4 years old. 80,000 Hungarian soldiers were dead or missing since the January 12th offensive, and another 63,000 had been injured. Although Horthy's generals remained largely loyal to the Axis, his diplomats were more devious. The Second Army's commander, General von Janney, rebuked his men with a famous document, of which Himmler's agents later obtained a photocopy, beginning, quote, "The Hungarian Second Army has lost its honor, for only a few men did the duty that was expected of them under their oath." End quote. But decoded radio messages established beyond doubt that the Hungarian Prime Minister Miklos von Kalay had eagerly grasped at Churchill's bumbling proposal to the Turkish government for a new Balkan League, consisting of Turkey, Hungary, and Romania, aligned against both the Soviet Union and the Axis powers. Himmler's agents obtained word of Calais' recent secret speech to the Foreign Policy Committee of his parliament, and the speech proved that he was not to be trusted. Hitler decided to bring pressure on Horthy to rid himself of Calais. So effective was the smokescreen of spurious intelligence being laid down before the Abwehr that Hitler had only his intuition to rely on in guessing where the war on the Mediterranean would turn next. Spain and Portugal seemed particularly vulnerable targets. Their occupation would prevent Hitler from seizing Gibraltar, impede his U-boat offensive in the Atlantic, and deprive him of the Iberian Peninsula's iron, tungsten, lithium, and tin. Canaris was twice sent to Madrid, but reported unenthusiastically. Spain, he said, neither could nor would voluntarily enter the war unless her neutrality were directly threatened. Hitler decided to furnish Franco with the weapons he would need. By February, it seemed clear that the British and Americans were massing strength near the border of Spanish Morocco, even at the expense of their front in Tunisia. Canaris went to Hitler's headquarters on the 9th and tried to kill these rumors, but Hitler ordered divisions in France moved up to the northern Spanish frontier. The next day, a naval officer wrote after attending a conference with Hitler, quote, "As to Spain's attitude, the Führer's mind was suddenly completely at ease. He had certain information, I don't know where from. At any rate, he said everything had been cleared up to our satisfaction." End quote. One of the war's most secret treaties had just been signed in Madrid. In return for a supply of modern German weapons, Franco now committed his country to fighting the British and Americans the moment they set foot in Spain, Portugal, or any Spanish possessions in the Mediterranean, Atlantic, and Africa. The enemy might equally hope to exploit partisan chaos in the Balkans. An Allied invasion there would bring the Romanian oil fields within bomber range. Hitler dictated his military commander in the southeast, General Alexander Lohr, to restore peace there, establishing, quote, "silence of the tomb if need be," unquote. In Croatia, as elsewhere, Italy was at the root of Hitler's troubles. Soon, the vital bauxite mines of Mostar were abandoned to their partisans. Their leadership, Josip Tito, escaped time after time until Hitler came to extend to him an admiration that he had previously reserved for Stalin. When Tito's partisan forces had become too powerful, the Italians had merely ignored Germany's protests and abandoned territory wholesale. General Rohata's Second Army had continued to arm the Chetnik Serbian irregulars against the partisans. In December, Ciano had unenthusiastically agreed to Hitler's demand that Chetniks be disarmed, but the army had ignored Mussolini's directive to that effect. Late in February, Hitler sent Ribbentrop to Rome with a strongly worded letter demanding more active Italian support against the Chetniks. He furnished dozens of radio messages decoded by his agencies, proving that the Chetniks were fighting for London. The new Italian chief of staff, General Ambrosio, furnished various excuses for not proceeding against them. Lohr came to Venice and proposed pacifying Croatia by installing at every level a German civil administration. Hitler's patience with the Italians was exhausted. He ordered Mostar and the bauxite mines recaptured, and he began planning a sharp war of annihilation against the Chetniks. Quote, On account of the intimate relations between the Chetnik commanders and the Italian authorities, the conference record stated, the Führer attaches particular importance to camouflaging our object and all the preparations, end quote. This operation, codenamed Black, would begin in mid-May 1943. If it were not for the political effect on Italy, Hitler would have long since withdrawn his divisions from Tunisia. His own interest in this distant theater of war was negligible. Quote, without optimism, military command is impossible, Hitler later meditated. I see Rommel, though he has his limitations, as an extraordinarily bold and clever commander, but he lacks staying power. Everybody thinks so. End quote. Varlamont returned from Tunis in mid-February, quoting Rommel's description of the bridgehead as a quote-unquote house of cards, which would collapse the moment Montgomery attacked, presumably 1 month hence when the moon was full. Ominously, the Allies had a 57-millimeter shell seemingly capable of piercing the Tiger tanks, pride of Hitler's armor. General von Arnim's 5th Panzer Army detected a weak spot facing them. However, the U.S. 2nd Corps on February 14th, On February 14th, General Ziegler struck at these inexperienced soldiers and drove a big salient toward the vital Kasserine Pass, taking hundreds of American prisoners. Starved of gasoline, even this German offensive failed. Canaris, visiting the bridgehead, quoted Arnim as saying, quote, "With the supply position as it is, 25,000 tons instead of the requisite 80,000 tons had arrived in February. You can work out with pencil and paper when the end will come." End quote. Characteristically, Rommel fell sick. A specialist confirmed to Hitler that he would have to go on leave by February 20th at the latest. Mysteriously, the moment he was given command of the army group with one German and one Italian army to defend Tunis, his illness cleared up. Rommel soon lost heart again when he saw Montgomery's preparations to attack his Marath Line in the south. On March 4th, Hitler was handed Rommel's discouraging opinion. The present Tunis battlefront was over 400 miles long. The enemy had 1,600 tanks, 1,100 anti-tank guns, and about 210,000 combat troops. Unless Hitler would authorize Rommel to withdraw to a far shorter front, the two armies would be overwhelmed. Not without justification, Hitler noted, quote, "That is a complete contradiction of his earlier contention, namely that a retreat to Tunisia would solve their strategic shortcomings." And that's the end of the quote as well. Jodl pointed out that Rommel's plan would make a gift of vital airfields to the enemy and allow the British generals Montgomery and Alexander to join forces against the bridgehead. Hitler refused to allow the withdrawal. Quote, "This is the end," he predicted nonetheless. They might just as well be brought back," end quote. And new quote, "on superior orders," as Rommel querulously wrote, he launched his attack on March 6th on Montgomery, but the same day he pulled back to the Marath Line. As Hitler had predicted, it was the end. From all appearances, as arranged by the British Secret Service, captured Italian officers had betrayed Rommel's plans, so Hitler did not reproach him. In fact, the British had once again deciphered all Rommel's signals. Hitler decided on the 8th to bring home Rommel before he could be tarnished by the inevitable defeat in Tunis. The recall remained a closely guarded secret. The reputation of Rommel would soldier on in absentia. A letter came from Mussolini, dated March 9th, confirming that the Axis must enlarge its bridgehead in Tunisia, and not reduce it as Rommel wished. Quote, "Because that would end with us beaten and with our backs to the sea," end quote. Hitler agreed and signaled to Rommel, quote, "The withdrawal of both your armies into a narrow bridgehead around Tunis and Biserta is the beginning of the end," end quote. "They must double up and even treble their shipments to the..." Treble? Or triple? It says treble. "Their shipments to the bridgehead." Hoping to persuade him against this, Rommel flew to Venice late that day, March 9th, and spent the evening alone with Hitler. The Führer turned a deaf ear on his pleas to shorten the front line. He betrayed an obvious conviction that the field marshal had become a defeatist. He intended, he said, to increase the supply rate to 150,000 tons a month. When Rommel's health improved, he should return to Africa and direct a new offensive westward to Casablanca. He dictated these lines to Mussolini, quote, "For the first time, I have been given the field marshal leave of absence to restore his health. I have given the field marshal leave of absence to restore his health. This is urgently necessary, both in the judgment of the doctors and on the evidence of my own eyes. I must ask you at all costs to keep Rommel's absence on leave absolutely secret. Whatever posterity may judge of Field Marshal Rommel, to his troops, and particularly to the German soldiers, he was beloved in every command he held. He was always dreaded as an opponent by his enemies. End quote. It seemed that Field Marshal Rommel was now a figure of the past. On March 1, 1943, hundreds of British night bombers rained high explosives and incendiaries on Berlin, leaving 35,000 homeless and over 700 dead. A low-level Luftwaffe fighter-bomber attack, ordered as a reprisal against London on March 5th, had to be scrubbed, as Hitler was apologetically told because of fog and the quote-unquote dead calm sea, evoking from Hitler the astonished query, quote, "Do our planes swim over then?" and unquote. Evoking from Hitler the astonished query, oh yeah, next line. Hitler blamed the indolent and sybaritic Field Marshal Sperla, commander of the 3rd Air Force, and called for a younger man to direct the attack. Goering was on an art purchasing expedition in Italy. Quote, "When does the Reichsmarschall get back?" Hitler demanded. "Things can't go on like this. We will never wear down the British like this." End quote. When Goebbels arrived on March 8th with Speer, Hitler was still furiously inveighing against the complete failure of the Luftwaffe. Man, this chapter is just full of words I'm not familiar with. Toward midnight, sitting with the visitors in his bunker, Hitler was just remarking sarcastically that he only had to picture his generals in a mufti to lose every shred of respect for them when he heard that the British had just launched a colossal air raid against Nuremberg, the medieval gem of architecture and seat of the party's affairs. Hitler had Goering's liaison officer, Bodenschatz, roused and rasped that the Reichsmarschall must return from Rome forthwith. Quote, The generals always knew better than I, he told Goebbels. Now the German public is paying the price. End quote. Goering arrived on the 11th. Quote, I told the Führer I am not an aircraft designer or technician, he said a week later, so I can't build the planes myself, nor can I develop new engines or equipment. End quote. His generals and experts had always bluffed him. His radar specialists had even excused their inability to test blind bombing devices by pleading bad weather. Over the next nights, Munich and Stuttgart were the bombers' targets. Overriding Goering, Hitler ordered the air war against Britain stepped up, and he appointed the youthful Colonel Dietrich Peltz, attack commander England, responsible not to the sluggish Sperla, but to the chief of air staff Jeschenik, and hence to Hitler alone. Putting these aggravations momentarily behind him, Hitler flew back out for the morning of March 10th to Manstein's headquarters at Zaporozhye in Russia. He was well satisfied with the events in the southern front. Manstein's two panzer armies had left 23,000 Russian dead on the battlefield between the Donets and Dnieper rivers. 615 tanks and 354 guns had fallen into his hands. Thereupon, an offensive against Stalin's Voronezh army group had resulted in the destruction of the enemy's 3rd Tank Army southwest of Kharkov, killing 12,000 of the enemy. Now Manstein's 4th Panzer Army, with its powerful SS Panzer Corps, was embarking upon the 5th battle fought over Kharkov. Quote, "The Führer lands at 10:40 a.m., noted the Luftwaffe's Field Marshal von Richthofen. Manstein and I drive in Führer's car to Army Group HQ. The Führer discusses the coming operations. Manstein keeps up his hate fest against Kleist, commander of Army Group A, the whole time, and Führer prompts Manstein to make hostile comments about Kleist and Kluge, his two neighbors. Führer, enjoying every minute, ribs me mercilessly but kindly. For some reason, addresses everybody as Herr Fieldmarschall. Today as a joke. Says he never wants to hear of the Romanians or our other gallant allies again." End quote. The snows were melting, turning the Eastern Front into its seasonal morass. The 300-mile nightmare breach had almost been stitched together, proof in Hitler's eyes that the Red Army had no reserves up its sleeve after all. Already the Russians were drafting their 17-year-olds. Perhaps the great collapse was in sight at last. In the south, the capture of Kharkov was now certain. And west of Moscow, Operation Buffalo was drawing to its brilliant conclusion. The Red Army, puzzled at this uncharacteristic retreat, had followed only hesitantly, stumbled upon well-laid minefields and booby traps, and suffered heavy casualties at no cost to the Germans. The retiring Germans had destroyed or dismantled everything of value to the enemy. Quote, "A battle won," concluded Kluge's army group. On March 13th, Hitler flew back to the Wolf's Lair in Rostenburg, East Prussia, calling first that afternoon at Smolensk headquarters for Kluge's army group center. 3 days before, on March 10th, Himmler had telephoned to Hitler's police bodyguard a warning to be on the lookout for parcel bombs. Hitler showed no concern. He was inspired by the buoyant mood of Kluge's officers at Smolensk. They were delighted at the tactical victory of the 4th and 9th Armies in Operation Buffalo. The new Buffalo Line was already built, a formidable line of barbed wire entanglements, bunkers, and anti-tank ditches. When Kluge asked if the objective of their coming summer campaign could be disclosed to them, Hitler astonished both Kluge and his staff with its modesty. Quote, "To hold the Eastern Front just as it is," that evening he was, "to hold the Eastern Front just as it is," end quote. That evening he was back in East Prussia at the Wolf's Lair, and there's an asterisk. In fact, Kluge's Abwehr officer, Colonel Rudolf von Gersdorf, and others claimed after the war that they planted a parcel bomb in Hitler's aircraft before it left Smolensk on March 13, 1943. Admiral Canaris, one of the plotters, wrote in his notes of the flight he made to Smolensk on March 8th, quote, "I conveyed time fuses and explosives in my plane to the Army Group's Abwehr 2nd Sabotage Unit," end quote. Since Canaris dined for 2 hours with Himmler on March 10th, it is tempting to assume that Canaris made an incautious remark to him about the bomb plot. But Himmler's files show that since March 3rd, parcel bombs posted by the Polish underground were causing some concern. Huh. All right. The prospect of a year, let's back up top, the prospect of a year on the defensive galled him. Quote, "I can't just let a whole year go to waste," he said. End quote. Zietzler agreed. The new East Wall was all very well, but he said, quote, "They will flatten us before we can finish it," end quote. Hitler responded, quote, "They are in such a state now that we would be lunatics not to exploit it," end quote. The fragmentary records of this war conferences reveal him already plotting with Zietzler a partial resumption of the offensive in order to regain the initiative on the Central Front. Zietzler hinted at April 15th as a suitable date. Quote, "One thing we must not say," insisted the Führer, "is this year just a few prods at the enemy. Next year, the big push. Perhaps this year we can win the war." Don't quite. End quote. Before March 13th was over, Hitler had signed Zietzler's order laying the foundations of Citadel, a combined attack by Kluge's and Manstein's army groups on a tempting enemy salient at Kursk. The next day, Sepp Dietrich's SS troops retook Kharkov. Hitler exuberantly telephoned to Goebbels, but the canny propaganda minister was against any special radio fanfare. It would undermine the very Dunkirk spirit he had labored to contrive in Germany. That evening, Goebbels telephoned back, appealing to be allowed to revive the anti-Jewish propaganda motif and badgering Hitler to complete evicting the Jews from the Reich as soon as possible. Hitler indulgently agreed, but when Himmler himself arrived at the Wolf's Lair on the 17th, the Führer apparently felt it necessary to speak a word of restraint. For the next day, Himmler telephoned to Gestapo Chief Heinrich Müller in Berlin that there was to be, quote, "no deportation of privileged Jews from France." Hitler's chronic ailment, his stomach spasms, had begun to recur. Professor Morell advised him to retire for a week or two at the Obersalzberg. With the Eastern Front now paralyzed by the thaw, Hitler bowed to their advice. Besides, at the Berghof, he would be closer to the Mediterranean theater. Admiral Canaris had twice warned that the enemy would occupy Sicily, Sardinia, and Corsica. It seemed high time for Hitler to meet the Duce. Thus, Hitler left the Wolf's Lair, though his absence would last for many weeks longer than he originally planned. Surrounded by his staff, he dined in the train's restaurant car with its red leather-covered chairs. The three secretaries joined him, Joanna Wolf, Krista Schroeder, and Trottle Humps, the newcomer. Schaub, Huell, Borman, and Morell sat in as well, the portly doctor waiting into the meal with an appetite that was as audible as it was evident. Hitler contented himself with mashed potato, an egg, and a dry biscuit. Trottle Humps later wrote, quote, "I was taken aback by the informal nature of the conversation. Borman, above all, was gentle and friendly. The Führer spoke softly and with restraint. After the meal, he asked for the ceiling lights to be switched off. He preferred subdued light, as his eyes were rather sensitive." End quote. A pot of caraway seed tea was served. Quote, "Delicious," exclaimed Hitler, but nobody accepted his offer of a cup. At intervals, the train halted and telephone messages were received. Hitler summoned a manservant. Quote, "Take Blondie for a walk outside," unquote. When the train began again, the dining car gently swaying, Morell snoring lightly, and one small table lamp casting a dim glow. At Rügenwalde in Pomerania the next morning, he dallied for a few hours to inspect Krupp's new giant gun, the quote-unquote Long Gustav, and various new tank prototypes undergoing trials in the ranges. Here at last was the new Ferdinand tank, a 70-ton monster powered by two diesel-electric engines, all but impregnable with its 8-inch thick armor plate and formidable 88mm gun. These and the Tiger tanks would surely overwhelm the Russians when Citadel began. Hitler was undismayed by the prevalent fear of Russian armies that were in fact a mere shadow of their name. Quote, "I am convinced the rogues are so weak," the stenographers heard him say, "and all they have against us are formations, but fragments alone exist, but they seem clear enough." That was the end of the quote. And that was parentheses, the last thing I said. "The fragments alone exist, but they seem clear enough." He invited Speer and Goebbels to dinner in the Berlin Chancellery and mentioned the high hopes he vested in the U-boat war. Goebbels mentioned that the Luftwaffe bomb London's... Goebbels recommended that the Luftwaffe bomb London's plutocratic districts rather than the working-class slums. When he channeled the conversation around to the Jews, Hitler congratulated him on having kicked most of them out of Berlin. Quote, "The war is enabling us to tackle a whole series of problems we could never have dealt with in normal times," end quote. Goebbels quoted him as saying. Half an hour after midnight on March 22nd, his train left Berlin, heading south. In Munich, Eva Braun joined it for the short journey onward to Berchtesgaden. Hitler's health was still indifferent, but he had begun taking handfuls of Dr. Koester's Antigas tablets, a patent medicine which had brought relief 7 years earlier. 2 days after Hitler, Professor Morell arrived at the Obersalzberg. Quote, "There are fawn, warm mountain wind conditions," he noted, "and sudden heat wave," end quote. Hitler sent for him at 9:30 after the war conference. Quote, "Complained of violent headache and throbbing head, temporal artery badly swollen, looking generally tired and languid," end quote. He found Hitler's blood pressure up and injected an iodine compound, reflecting that his patient had been living in low-pressure areas since mid-November. Quote, "And now this sudden change. Moreover, up to a week or 10 days ago, he's been worrying constantly about the consolidation of the Eastern Front during the actual injections," end quote, recorded Morell. "His head began to clear a short time later. The throbbing stopped. Sat up in an animated conversation until 2:30 a.m. at the fireside, but no fire, and made sure he got fresh air," end quote. Few records of his military conferences of the following weeks exist. Apart from Citadel, we know that Hitler was looking ahead to a further offensive against Leningrad in the summer. He was also casting around for some way of regaining the initiative in the West. Quote, "Gisela, a Nazi occupation of northern Spain, was won. I guess it was quote-unquote Gisela. But he had begun to reconsider a lightning invasion of Iceland, too, Operation Icarus, which Raeder had barely talked him out of in 1940. Mussolini was not due to come until April 7th. Before then, Hitler had only a little publicized meeting with King Boris, one of his trustier allies. It was so informal that at one stage, one of Hitler's secretaries made an unheralded appearance munching an apple and clutching a pair of tennis rackets. Quote, "Don't worry yourself," Hitler consoled her afterwards. "Even kings are only human." End quote. In these weeks at the Berghof, Hitler looked briefly into some Third Reich problems he had too long ignored. Others he avoided. Thus, when Reichsfuhrer Himmler came on March 30th, the discussion revolved solely around the military affairs of the SS, according to Himmler's note. Himmler did not raise with Hitler the progress made on the quote-unquote Jewish problem during their two-hour mountain stroll. Earlier in 1943, Himmler had submitted to him a statistical report on a similar topic, the population transfers he had sponsored since October 1939. In 3 years, Himmler had resettled 629,000 ethnic Germans from outside the Reich, and 400,000 more were still to come. In the same period, 365,000 Poles were dumped in the general government of Poland, and 295,000 French citizens were evicted from Alsace, Lorraine, and Luxembourg. Did Hitler ever see the other statistical report that the Reichsfuhrer had commissioned at the same time on the, quote, final solution of the Jewish problem in Europe, unquote? In dry tables, Himmler's chief statistician, Dr. Richard Kohr, had analyzed the fate of the world's estimated 17 million Jews. Europe's 10 million had dwindled by 45% since 1937, owing to emigration, the high natural mortality rate, and the enforced quote-unquote evacuation that had begun with the prohibition of emigrations late in 1941. To Himmler's annoyance, on reading the 16-page document on March 27th, he found that it stated expressis verbis on page 9 that of the 1,449,692 Jews deported from the eastern provinces, 1,274,166 had been subjected to quote-unquote special treatment at the camps in the general government, and a further 145,301 similarly dealt with in the Werthergau. Dr. Korer, it should be said, still denies that the words meant that the words meant liquidated. Quote-unquote liquidated. On April 1st, Himmler had the report abridged, quote, for submission to the Führer, end quote. And a few days later, he instructed that he, quote, did not want there to be any mention of, quote-unquote, special treatment of Jews, whatever, end quote. According to the new text, the Jews would have been channeled through the camps to Russia, not, quote, subjected to special treatment, unquote, at the camps. As Himmler explained to his staff on April 9th, the report would serve magnificently for, quote-unquote, camouflage purposes in later years. Mussolini arrived at Salzburg Station on April 7th. The Italians were housed at Klesheim, an enchanting Baroque chateau near Salzburg, which had been lavishly restored. And here a short series of what Zietzler contemptuously dubbed Gala War Conferences was held for Mussolini's benefit. Hitler did what he could to inspire Mussolini with the coming campaigns in the East, but the two dictators were moved by different purposes. Mussolini still wanted an armistice with Stalin, to enable the Axis to throw all its might against Britain and the United States, and he handed to Hitler a memorandum on the possible negotiations, given the Allies' poor showing over the Russian convoys and a second front. Stalin had good cause to be disaffected. The Duce believed that Spain would voluntarily join the Axis. To Hitler, all this was disappointingly naive. If fascism in Italy was not to be overthrown, so he advised... Wait a minute. If fascism in Italy was not to be overthrown, so he advised Mussolini, they must hold on to Tunis at all costs. This meant that the Italian Navy must throw every fast cruiser and destroyer it had into the supply operations for Tunisia. The Duce asked for more oil for the ships, and Hitler agreed to supply it. Each evening, he was driven back up to the Berghof, where he was greeted by the barking of Eva Braun's two untidy black Scotties and Eva herself, elegantly clad in the latest fashions. That spring, she organized regular film shows for his staff in the basement, bowling alley, but Hitler piously stayed away. Quote, "In wartime, the people called upon to make such sacrifices, I cannot watch movies. Besides," he added, "I must save my eyesight for reading maps and dispatches." You guys should remember that. Don't waste your time on fucking movies. The same priggish considerations militated against his wearing more comfortable clothes. A Churchill, he noted, might gamble about the world dressed in silk blouses and cowboy hats, but not the Führer of the German Reich. Quote, "But the moment the war is over," he said, "I am going to hang my uniform on a nail, retire here, and let somebody else take over the government. As an old man, I shall write my memoirs, surrounded by clever, intellectual people. I never want to see another officer." End quote. They were long evenings that spring, for Hitler refused to go to bed until the last enemy bomber had left Germany's airspace. In March alone, 8,000 tons of bombs had rained down on Germany, sometimes 1,000 tons a night, on single cities like Duisburg, Essen, and Berlin. On April 4th, American air raids killed 228 civilians in Paris and 221 in Naples. On the 5th, an American raid on the Belgian port of Antwerp massacred 2,130 civilians. Hitler's interest in the Army's long-range missile project increased, and on March 29th, he had already approved Speer's blueprints for a huge concrete missile site on the Channel coast, from which Britain would be bombarded once missiles were available. As Goering's prestige declined, the rivalry of the other satraps increased. Speer was an almost permanent visitor to the Berghof throughout April. Goebbels came and went, but Bormann was lord of the manor here. He had secured Hitler's signature to a document appointing him his official, quote-unquote, secretary. He had the right to, quote, "communicate the Führer's decisions and opinions to the Reich ministers and other departments and agencies," unquote. A formidable prerogative. He alone now decided which non-military applicants might see Hitler and which documents would be shown to him. Bormann's powers became vast. His eyes were everywhere. His energy was prodigious. His loyalty beyond question.